And there's seats at the front if anybody wants to take a seat. I've just run through the structure of what's happening. The structure of the day is written on the whiteboard over there behind you. We're going to have the panel talks and then a general discussion. At 5:40 we will have a break, which will be exactly 10 minutes and no longer. And then we will come back and have a brief introduction to the G20 and launch into a more focused discussion. 7 o'clock, hopefully promptly, is dinner, and then at 8 o'clock there'll be an extended Greek talk, and at 9 o'clock there's bands, and at 12 o'clock we have to finish because of licensing things. The talks are being audio recorded, but the general discussion won't be, but you might be asked later if you want to do an interview, which you could say yes or no to, but you won't be recorded without your permission. Please use hands during the discussion, not shouting out, obviously. There's some prisoner cards in the other room for Greek prisoners, just in the corner there, which it'd be good if you can sign. There's going to be an ideas board here, and we have an ideas monitor with three different coloured pens who will write down ideas as they come up. So hopefully when we have the more focused discussion, those ideas can be looked into more if they seem appropriate. The talks are meant to inspire and inform and promote through their ideas, but let's not get bogged down in the specifics. Like, you don't need to correct whether something happened on a Tuesday or a Wednesday and things like that. If you want to clarify or get more info on the individual struggles talked about, see the speakers afterwards, because we do want to keep the discussion as things that are happening that are relevant for everybody here. During the discussion, if I feel conversation is getting mouldy or stunted or it's very circular, I will move things on. So don't think I'm being rude. And try and be here with an open mind, not a fixed political position. Thank you. First talking is Kia. He's our homegrown representative, and he's going to open and close the discussion. So think of him as a doorman with shiny buttons and a big hat.
Is that my cue?
That's your cue.
I just wanted to sort of introduce the idea behind this meeting and what the people who organised it were trying to get out of it, basically, where this meeting came from, basically, so we all have that information. It's been organised by a sort of a very loose group and fairly new group in Leeds called We Won't Pay for Their Crisis, and it's loosely called that as well. And basically that came out of a group of friends discussing, or people who knew each other, well, actually we are friends, discussing the crisis and about how, this crisis is just presented to us as though, you know, we're at the whims of some like mysterious natural forces, you know, and the causes of this crisis just seem to be abstract and a million miles away from our own lives. And yet, you know, it's obvious that it's going to dominate our lives over the next perhaps even 10, 20 years, basically. And so we were trying to talk about some way in which we could try and get a grip on things. So, you know, some way we could take action and try and get a grip on events. Because, you know, the worst position to be put in is that you're some sort of passive observer on your own life. And that's how this crisis has been arranged so far. You know, there's just things happening, banks folding. They have a massive effect on our lives, and how can we act on them? And so there was a series of discussions about what we could do, and it's actually very difficult. That's partly why we've organised this meeting, and that's partly what this ideas monitor is for. Is, you know, when ideas come up about how we could take action, how we can, you know, regain a bit of control over all these events, we're going to be putting them up here, and we're going to discuss them now. You know, if we don't discuss all the ideas that get put up, we're going to have, more meetings in the future. So this group, We Won't Pay for Their Crisis, it's been having sort of fortnightly meetings, but on a very small scale. And we want a bigger group, perhaps even get rid of that name, you know. But we want something else to come out of this this meeting. And so, any ideas that aren't fully discussed today, we can take up again and act on in the future. Anyway, the first idea we had for how we could act was, or an idea came about on a forum, a price reduction campaign. And this was at the end of last year. And if you remember, one of the first effects of this crisis, one of the first effects that fed through to us, was a huge increase in price of food. And not just in this country, around the world. I think there were food riots in something like 26 different countries last year. That's a huge, you know, that's perhaps the first, that's a huge movement, actually. It didn't seem like it at the time, but, you know, that's a really significant movement. And so what we were trying to work out what we could do about it, and then an idea got raised in other parts of the country as well about organising big meetings outside supermarkets where people discuss this. Somebody brings along the, you know, the amount of profits that Tesco is making and say, look, you know, this you know, we're going to set a fair price. We're going to have negotiations with a manager to reduce these prices. Well, unfortunately, we're now in a deflationary situation where prices are falling. But in fact, when you think through this story, it's actually pretty, you know, it not only shows how it's difficult to act in this crisis, but it's actually, you know, important to. So the reason that food prices started going upwards, or part of the reason for that, was that there was a lot of money sloshing about which could not be invested in the stock market because stock prices were obviously going to fall. And so money started getting speculated, getting put into commodities, speculating on commodities. And one of those, the big commodities, was food prices. So food prices shoot up, right? And then that money goes somewhere else and they shoot down before we can organize to take action against it. You know, but our essentials, like food, should not be at the whim of speculators and speculation. You know, people were starving. And that should not happen. So it shows partly why we have to get a grip on this, but secondly, how difficult it is. And so the second idea we had for how we could act was to try and reduce the prices on public transport. So on the 2nd of January this year, train prices went up from between 6 and 11%. And so we the first sort of Monday back to work, we leafleted the train station saying, you know, this is just insane, especially in a time of climate change when we should be trying to reduce car. This utter insanity, you know, we're not going to stand for it. Unfortunately, we were a bit late coming to this, because once prices are in, it's quite hard to campaign around them. You need to make a big, big build-up to try and prevent them coming in. But basically, we're open to... that's why we're open to ideas of how we can get some sort of grip on this and try and gain some more control over our lives, basically. And so this is the next thing we wanted. This meeting is the next sort of thing we're doing. And it may seem like I'm talking about local struggles around local issues, or apparently local issues. So it might seem strange that we've got speakers from different countries here. All three of these countries that they're going to talk about, there's been really big, significant movements related to this crisis. You know, in Iceland, the government's been toppled and so forth. You know, but these aren't like examples that we think Britain should follow, you know, and they can't be because they're all completely different for a start. But one, they should be an inspiration to us. We might take some inspiration. Two, they just show the scale of this crisis, basically, that it is a global crisis. And also the scale of the movements that we're going to need to evolve in order to get some sort of grip on it. So this is a global crisis, you know. And so when we start talking about how we can take action in Leeds, we've got to not only take action in Leeds, we've got to start thinking about how that connects up to, you know, not only like Europe, but globally as well. Because we're going to have like movements linked up across the world. You know, it's not the first time this has happened, you know. That started to happen around the turn of the century, around all the anti-Semitic stuff. But that's the sort of scale we're looking at, and it's pretty hard to keep your head. When we're talking about, you know, trying to reduce prices in Tesco's up the road, it's quite hard to think, how does that relate to, you know, struggles all around the world? And that's unfortunately, you know, the complicated situation that we're in. And the other way that this is, the scale of this crisis becomes apparent is that, like, this is not just another one of those, you know, that cycle of boom and bust that happens, you know, in a couple of years, we'll all be back to the way it was. Do you know what I mean? Basically, we're in a new era, right? All those property development programs with Sarah Beeny and all that sort of stuff. You know, the fact that I know what curb appeal is, right? All of those are from a different historical era. Do you know what I mean? They're gone. We can only look at them now like historians, basically. That's all gone. It's not coming back. Do you know what I mean? It's a real fundamental crisis. And so that means when we're thinking about how we struggle, it's not just like the global scale we have to think about. It's time scale as well, right? So... the first, we've got to struggle against the effects of this crisis, like job repossessions, job losses, repossession of housing, utility prices going up. All of these effects, we're getting the shitty end of the stick. We're being made to pay for the crisis, basically. But we've also got to think slightly longer term as well, because, so for instance, we're going to be talking a bit later about the G20 meeting in London, you know, and international leaders are getting together to work out the new regime. You know, basically, nobody has an idea how to get out of this crisis, right? Don't let anybody fool you, right? But they're meeting to try and work out, you know, how things are going to play out over the next 20 years, okay? This crisis is probably like the collapse of the last 30 years' direction of the world be moving in. And they're trying to work out what the next 20 years is going to be like. And we have to act now, or we're going to be stuck in their plans, basically, in the world of their plans, which is going to be probably unpleasant for us all. And on top of that, there's a longer time scale thing going on, which is climate change. That is a climate crisis going on at the same time, okay, and it's linked. And so at the same time, in December or November, there's a big meeting in Copenhagen where they're going to meet, they're going to be discussing the next, like, you know, there was this Kyoto Treaty that got discussed and then America never signed and didn't get anywhere. And now they're working out the next, agreement on climate change and the next scheme that they're going to trying to perhaps address climate change to some extent. So we've also got that sort of time scale, which is even longer time scale to think about, which makes things even more complicated, but it also makes them even more, you know, urgent and necessary. Okay, that's all I'm going to say now. So we'll have a few speakers from different countries. Who's speaking next?
Okay, thanks, Kit. Our next speaker is Antonis from Occupied London. That's a magazine, not the place. He has some Occupied Londons with him, which are donations, and the money will go to prisoners who have been taken during the Greek revolt. He's giving a short intro now and will be doing a more detailed, longer talk and film later after dinner.
Yeah, okay, so I guess what I'm mostly, my main reason for being here is to talk about the Greek revolt. But in these 10 minutes I've got in this panel, I'm going to completely bypass the revolt itself. And I just want to talk to you about two very brief moments from Greece in December and January. And they might first seem fairly relevant to what we're going to be talking about here today, so please bear with me, because I'm going to explain how I think they're actually very much linked up. So there's two events that have happened in Greece since December, after the revolt, that in my opinion, in many people's opinions, couldn't have happened before the revolt and couldn't have happened without it. The first one is the story of Konstantina Kuneva, who's a migrant cleaner and a trade unionist in Athens. And there's actually some leaflets going around. I don't know where the rest of them are. Yeah, there's a few more over there. Basically explaining her story in detail. And there's a number of reasons why her story is really important. Konstantina was attacked. She was a radical grassroots trade unionist in Athens at her workplace. And on the 23rd of December, that is around 16 days into the revolt, right in the middle of the revolt, she was attacked by some thugs who were obviously paid by her employing company. And what they did is that they threw acid, sulfuric acid, I think it's called, onto her eyes and forced her to drink some of it too. So Konstantina's now basically, definitely lost eyesight from one of her two eyes, probably might actually lose eyesight from a second as well. Doesn't seem like she's going to be able to be fed properly again. It was a very severe attack, a murderous attack. Her story is very barbaric, but it's not necessarily unique in the sense that I'm afraid that there must be very similar stories happening across the world and across Greece that we just don't get to hear about. What was quite amazing about Konstantina's story and was exceptional was the wave of solidarity that developed around her case. So 4 days after the attack, the headquarters of her employing company were occupied by people in solidarity who held it for a good few days, maybe weeks. There was occupations all across the country, there was demonstrations, and this kind of movement, one of its peak moments was this demonstration in Athens, and I wanted to double check the date, I think it's the 22nd of January, so it was 1 month after the attack, 10,000 people marched in Athens in solidarity with Konstantina. And, you know, this is the kind of movement that we're talking about, a completely grassroots, kind of like genuinely grassroots movement that developed in solidarity with her. Now, The reason why this is so important is that it's just impossible, even by the Greek standards. There might already be some, like, you know, intense social kind of antagonism going on, but there's absolutely no way that you would have got 10,000 people on the streets marching for a migrant cleaner that was attacked at the workplace. This is just something completely out of the Greek reality, as we knew it before December. It just wouldn't happen, not even in our best kind of dreams. And this is something that did happen. So this is one moment that we can keep from the revolt that kind of continues into date. And it's one kind of reaction that the movement developed that's very positive. So during the revolt, I'm going to talk about this in much more length, I hope, in the evening. But during the revolt, this is one of the things that people did. You know, when the trade union congress, a kind of reformist trade union congress, refused to call for an indefinite strike, people occupied their headquarters in response. When the journalists, the mainstream kind of media, like, refused to cover the revolt, people occupied the headquarters of a journalist trade union. You know, there was a direct kind of action that was like a main element of the revolt. You know, people, which also, of course, replies to this kind of argument that the revolt had no demands. Of course it did, and they were very kind of direct. It wasn't even demanding, which is even better. It was just like people were taking what was theirs. So there's something at the state, and this you can see in the example of Konstantina's case. When people saw that one of our own is being attacked, they took direct action in response, and they took to the streets, which is quite amazing. But of course, this is what happens on our side. Now, what happens on the other side, which is the side of the state and the kind of order that is in danger, what happened is probably best exemplified by what happened in Athens on Tuesday, last Tuesday, 5 days ago. This is probably a story maybe many of you haven't heard about because it really wasn't covered in national or international media. But there was a severe attack. Basically, this social center in Exarchia in Athens, which is the area where the revolt started from, it's the area where, you know, kind of traditional anarchist and lefty area. So right in the heart of this area is this place called the migrant place, which is basically a space used by lefty and migrant groups. And someone, which is most certainly a fascist, walked up to the place and threw a hand grenade, luckily not through the window, to the window. It was a double glazed window. The first layer broke, the second one didn't. So the hand grenade bounced back and exploded outside. If a hand grenade had gone through the window, there was about 40 people in a meeting there. A conscientious objectators assembly. We would have had a good few dead, not just one or two, but definitely a few of them. So it was pure luck. I mean, this was a murderous attack, and it was just pure luck that there was no dead there. So it's clear that they want. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, history kind of repeats itself. They want the strategy of tension. They want dead. They want dead from our side, so that, you know, for whatever reasons, they want to repeat what happened in Italy in the 70s, basically. And of course, there was no coverage of this event in the media whatsoever. The very brief mentions that there were really, really dirty, kind of distorted, kind of claiming, or that maybe it was actually a kind of like a disagreement within lefty groups itself. So maybe some lefty groups were trying to, like, you know, had some sort of disagreement with that group and, like, were trying to take revenge for whatever reason. So of course, it's bullshit. I mean, we can't even begin to think that something like this would have happened. So it's basically, it's these two images. I'm trying to bring in two images because mainly to correspond to the title of today's event, which is, you know, we're an image from the future, which was one of the main slogans of the revolt in Athens. That what was happening right there was something that we're going to be seeing over and over again. And I think, in my opinion, these are both images from a future that we're actually living, you know, right now. You know, on the one hand, you have an amazing wave of solidarity. It's an amazing kind of putting to practice this slogan that came out of a revolt that said nothing should be remain unanswered no more. You know, any sort of provocation, any sort of attack from their side, we have to respond to, we have to reply, we have to challenge. And this is what happens. You know, people are just looking for the next opportunity, not just an excuse. It's not an excuse no more. You're just looking for the next. You know, you want to be out on the street fighting them, fighting their order, and you're just looking for the next visible kind of like target, the next kind of obvious opportunity to do so. So Konstantina's case was a very clear case. You know, we're talking about a migrant, a woman, a precarious worker, low-wage worker, who actually denied the role that was like imposed on her and like challenged it actively and said, you know, I'm going to take action against this through like a grassroots trade union. I mean, it doesn't become more obvious than this. And of course, for this, she was attacked. So this is a perfect kind of like kind of symbol around which to mobilize. So you've got this, and on the other hand, you've got their kind of response, which again, I mean, this kind of attack on Tuesday is something that we wouldn't even begin with to imagine. You know, we know that they're fascists, they're ruthless, we know that they've got knives, that they've got, you know, that they might stab comrades, that they might attack on the street. But this kind of blind attack where you want like tens, you want scores of dead, this is something that's completely, you couldn't imagine before December. So how does all this relate to the global talk about the crisis? I mean, it's what Keir was saying, we live in a new kind of era already. It's here, you know, it's happening, it's something new. We have to start thinking under new terms. You know, this is a new condition that we're facing. It's a new condition that they're facing because they see that we're mobilizing on a completely different level than before. And they are going to act because they want to kind of like save what they've got. So talks like this tonight are more than important, very essential for us to go forward. You know, we have to try to think of new ideas of how to link up all these struggles.
Thank you, Antonis. And there's two black cars blocking the exit there, so people can't get out. What did you know their number plates? And so she needs to get out. So if that's your vehicle, can you go and move it, please? Also, there's a couple of seats around the front, so it's a good opportunity if you haven't got a seat at the back to sit here if you'd like. Antonis, we'll make sure that Constantina gets one of the cards. And is she still getting money for medical expenses?
Well, people are collecting money for her, basically. So it's not really... It's very grassroots mobilization again. So that's one thing I'd like to do at some point today, maybe to put around a hat or something and see if people would be up for...
Well, we can make sure some of the money that we raise tonight...
Sure.
...for the bands and dinner goes as well. But yeah, I think we can put extra donations in.
Yeah.
That would be great. No one wants these seats then. Okay, fine. We're going to move to colder lands now. Skip's going to explore Iceland for us. Iceland has a very different background to Greece. It doesn't have the recent history of resistance that Greece has. It doesn't have this sort of massive anarchist mobilisation already in existence, which Greece is very proud to have. But the recent events have been sort of inspirational and quite sort of unprecedented move in that a group of people have actually brought down the government, and this has been... And the anarchists have played a very important role in it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, Iceland's gone from the position of being the fourth richest country in the world per capita to now having had its economy absolutely collapse so severely. And whilst that's happened, there's been an unprecedented social movement that's risen up and has actually ousted the government and has got aims that go all the way from ousting all of the elites to utter total revolution. Some people are calling it the Fleece Revolution. I think that's a really crappy name. It's got all kinds of names, the Hoodie Revolution. And anyway, so I'll be talking about this. And there's currently a kind of, when they overthrew the government, the kind of interim government came in, who's the leader is gay, and it's the first gay prime minister or head of state in modern times. So there's kind of issues relating to that. I mean, basically what happened with Iceland's economy is that, very simply, the banks just took out massive loans, got themselves into massive debt. I won't go too specifically into what they spent their money on, but they bought half of Britain's high street. That's kind of one thing that said internally in Iceland. It's very clear what they spent the money on. They spent the money on massive dam projects and massive aluminium projects and geothermal plant projects. So Iceland's, you know, it's gone from being the fourth richest country, and that was its sort of known as its good years, but it was also absolutely devastating for its environment and wilderness. So they spent all this money, the credit crunch came along. You know, investors wanted their money back. Iceland realized, oh crap, we can't give you any money back because we don't have any money ourselves. All three banks collapsed in the 7th, 8th and 9th of October, leaving a debt of 160,000 euros per person, six times the GDP in Iceland, roughly. It's 50 billion euros between 300,000 people. Although banks collapsed and they became under receivership. Well, what was the response in Icelandic society? I'll tell you a little story, and I hope that the person who said this to me listened to this on indie media. I was talking to an Icelandic anarchist, a really good guy who's been involved in Icelandic anarchist politics for years, and he said to me, just as this collapse was happening, he said, you know, these fucking Icelanders are never going to get off their asses. They're just going to get themselves totally screwed and they are not going to lift a finger and this country is going down the drain. And since that, there have been weekly demonstrations which went up to about 3% of the population coming out, daily demonstrations with pots and pans, mass people's assemblies every week renting out the biggest stadiums and the biggest seated halls in the countries to have just discussions about what the hell to do, where they didn't allow politicians into the auditorium to talk unless they ordered them to. They had fierce demonstrations where they pelted Parliament with paint and eggs and yogurts and pelted the politicians' cars and attempted to free political prisoners forcefully out of police stations. They lit protest fires outside Parliament for just endlessly, and like the same as in Greece, burned down the Parliament's Christmas tree. Just, this is so unprecedented. Iceland was so quiet. You know, the demands went from everything from they wanted the government to just step down to everything from forming a new republic with a new constitution and or just getting rid of the state altogether. 5 minutes already? Okay. So basically... okay, where that movement came from, very, very briefly, there was a movement that came to Iceland, which started off actually from the UK, called Saving Iceland, which went to Iceland, into the Icelandic wilderness and brought direct action and really confrontational tactics of dealing with Iceland's industrialization. And that's kind of where people are saying that this movement's come from this group Saving Iceland. Okay, so what was the elite response? The elite response was to blame each other. It's the same as we have here. The bank-owned media, the media in Iceland is owned by mostly one person who was one of the heads of the banks, and the rest is owned by another banker. So they basically wanted to ignore the whole issue, and people were reading British newspapers and American newspapers to find out their local news. The government at the time, we're talking about the previous government that's been in power for over a decade. It's just been so entrenched in society that it would never leave. And it's now out. But that government took out an IMF-led rescue package, which was about $11 billion big. That's something I'll get to in a bit. That basically means the government went and took out more debt to get themselves out of debt. The politicians were just saying things like, "Oh well, this is a you know, not really a quote, but you know, this is kind of the sentiment. Oh well, we may all be dysfunctional, but we are a dysfunctional family after all, and as a family, we should forgive and stand together." So that was kind of the attitude. Because of this movement that came out to oppose the government, eventually the government collapsed. A month ago, on the 26th of January, they collapsed, and the government collapsed. And towards that mass movement, you saw really unprecedented repercussions against them, like, for example, the first use of tear gas against demonstrators in Iceland since 1949, when Icelanders were demonstrating against NATO having a base. So this collapse of the government, people are calling the, whatever, some revolution. So now we have, as I said, this leftist kind of government in power. They're an interim government. There's elections coming up in April. They people see this as a civil rights victory because it's a woman and there's a and she's gay in power. So people are comparing it to a black American president. They're committed to social values, women's rights, and equality and justice. I don't know. There's a very obvious point here. She wasn't elected in, and she's this prime minister who's in there now isn't going to be standing for the election. So whether she's put in there now, it's hardly a great statement of people's power that she was just placed there. Economically, they are facing, you know, they have all these kinds of big initiatives, similar to maybe in America and also Britain. They have all these initiatives, but, well, they don't really have, they've got so much debt, so who knows actually if they're going to be able to do anything. They've said that they're going to carry on with the IMF deal, which is, I'll talk about that in a second. And they, basically, in Iceland, really, the prime ministers in Iceland, the government, actually isn't the most really of the important elite. The most important, really the most powerful person in Iceland is actually the head of the Icelandic National Bank, a guy called David Oddsson, who's was the ex-prime minister, and he's called the blue hand of Iceland. This guy has just got such a grip on Icelandic politics. He's still there, and the new government has demanded that he resigns, and he's refused, and so this is a kind of an issue. People still want him out. The IMF. Basically, this is really terrifying. The IMF call themselves the credit sector's enforcement agency. It's like taking a loan from a loan shark. You have to pay it back, otherwise you get effectively an economic gun pointed at your head. You have to pay their loans back. What is Iceland going to do as an economy which is massively shrinking now with rising unemployment? What's it going to do to pay it back? Well, the IMF usually gets you to sell off everything that you have, all your assets. In Iceland, their biggest assets really are their fish and their wilderness. So it looks pretty terrifying that the IMF might actually start really pushing Iceland to just sell off all of its wilderness and all of its rivers, as in turn them into massive dams and aluminium factories. Also, very troublingly, there's been a discovery of a big oil source near Iceland. So that's also something that looks like it's going to be in the future. Okay. Since this new interim government has come in, the demonstrations have actually really quelled. They've really quietened down. And it seems like actually a lot of what the demonstrations were people from these kinds of leftist parties or sympathetic to these leftist parties who actually just want these leftist parties to come in. The demonstrations have quelled down, and the more radical demands, you know, such as setting Iceland up as a country which wasn't just enslaved to whatever, which was independent, really aren't going to get through with this party. So there's a really big issue with that. How long have I got? Have I already overstepped it?
I don't know.
That's yes.
Yes, you
have. Right. Okay. So the demonstrations have quelled down. The elections are coming up in a few months. And right now, there are very interesting things. What this movements have carried through, despite the victory that they've got in having overthrown the government, is and the movement's quelling generally, is that it has really instilled a new kind of sense of radicalism amongst Icelanders and a new like critique of everyday life. They're having Reclaim the Streets parties, which they're forcefully defending from the cops, and just all sorts of new social movements are emerging, like feminist and anarchist and all kinds of really interesting things. So if this leftist government gets into power in the elections, then the way it's going to look is probably, no one really knows. But what's really scary, actually, is that it looks like there's even a possibility that this government, which has been ousted, might actually get back in, which is a terrifying scenario. It's like, it's just absolutely terrifying, and it's going to have a severe backlash on all of the anarchists who are going to be the first to get the doors kicked in. But also it would cause a massive social movement, so that's an interesting dynamic. If this really rightist government gets back in, then it will inflame things so much. So that's a really interesting thing to think about. on the one hand, if they get a kind of a leftist government, it's quelling, and on the other hand, it might really actually make people fight for their overall aims, which are overthrowing the state completely. So it's very interesting times happening in Iceland.
Thanks for that. I realise it's frustrating because it's such a sort of quick snapshot of what's happening in these different countries, but it skips around all day, so you can always talk to him afterwards if you want more information about it. I'm sure I'll be happy to give you some information. Okay, Enrico is going to talk to us about Italy, in particular sort of the student uprising, the role of fascism, and people's reaction to the crisis.
Yeah, well, first of all, let's clarify a few things about Italy in terms of crisis and economical crisis. People should understand, like, Italy always felt on a crisis in a way, or since I'm alive at least. So, yeah, economically, people haven't really touched it yet, haven't really experienced it yet directly. They're just hearing about it, so it's not something you can really touch on a ground level. And also that the way people reacted to it, it's not necessarily a direct reaction to it. So probably we better look at the behavior of these people reacting on it. That actually changed a few things since we were used to. For example, well, the main example is the student uprising that happened during the past months, like October, November, and December mainly. That was, let's say, started from a government proposal to change some educational, basically to cut funds to schools. That's why, like, mainly students uprised. But this time was different in a way compared to other, because every year almost they did some kind of cut, the cutting on funds, so people are kind of going protesting against it. This time you could tell it was different, first of all, because, again, not good on our side, but there was this new, let's say, fascist student bloc that uprised, and they got more and more organized, mainly exploiting the fear that is going around on people anyway, and around how they not trust the government, they don't trust politicians, and they're always trying changing one side to another kind of thing. So let's say in this like social environment, lots of fascist groups managed to exploit it, and we have to admit kind of cleverly. They often took, let's say, our things or messages and turned them into some kind of right wing. But that was kind of appealing for more people, for many people. We can see this mainly in two separate facts. One, there was this occupation of university. It was mainly, I think it was in November, where some fascist car arrived trying just to, you know, to bother students really. And there was a kind of a big riot outside university where police were involved. And from that day, let's say students evolved differently and they kind of didn't want to be manipulated by other politicians or other big names that still are part of the left-wing movement, but they're kind of considered very, you know, kind of mainstream, let's say. So you could see the first reactions on demos, like student demos, related to the same issue, but where like famous people just appeared, you know, just have a go. But then we all know that journalists would have turned the whole demo into them, basically, focusing attention. So we start seeing students kicking out famous people from demonstrations because they don't want them to be part of it. They just want it to be a proper student thing from the law, as we say. And the name they actually, I don't know if they were given this name or they chosen, is anomalous wave. I don't know if you get the meaning of it, but basically, yeah, a strange wave. Anyway, we can tell it has been different. And then there was this big fact in Rome, a big student demo was the end of October, I think. I'm not precisely sure about the dates anyway. Where there was this situation where the fascists auto-organized themselves without really letting many people know, but they organized a student bloc where they appeared, let's say many of them, or at least it looks like there were many, because they managed to get involved other, let's say, average students that they were just on strike, really, not really sure which demonstration to go to, kind of thing. So, yeah, by the media point of view, we can see, like, many fascists, let's say, students in a big square. As soon as a riot started, and I'm going to tell you now how it started, all these people were 15, basically. All skinheads with, like, sticks with a tricolor, I mean, the Italian flag on it. So, like, yeah, typically fascists. Because all the other people, of course, left because they weren't even willing to riot. And this was actually a, yeah, from an anarchist point of view, kind of a unique situation because it's probably haven't happened for like 30 years, that you could actually say fascist on a demo without coppers surrounding them and actually have a free riot, let's call it. It didn't happen for years. So even this situation for the comrades there was taken a bit in a weird way. They wouldn't know how to act, really. But all it happens was a big riot. They were, yeah, basically beaten up, but not too much, because the coppers was basically just behind them, ready to get them and to save them. I mean, even if on TV, they look like they're on the floor being arrested by the police. If you just hear the audio and the way they talk to each other, you can tell it was something pre-organized before, and the coppers were there to basically save them. I mean, probably the people inside those 15 fascists we're talking about, there were probably three of them that knew what was going to happen. The other were just naive, in a way. They really believed on it, and they went for it. And they all got nicked by, in a way, nothing happened to them. But this is to show how, like, this right-wing movement started exploiting this kind of crisis and desperate situation, where even, like, even average students that probably before didn't even want to take part or put themselves on a side, they now did. And so this thing kind of goes on even, I mean, yeah, I would need like probably a day to talk about it. But anyway, briefly, in the past years, there are more and more social centers, as we speak, like these kind of places run by fascists. I know that sounds weird, but that's what they do. Completely different politics sometimes. Some other times, they almost have the same politics. And we hate to say that, but it's actually, yeah, decreasing the movement, like reputation for that. But even, anyway, to go back to the connection to this, to the crisis, something that, yeah, as I said, Italy can't really fail it economically yet. Also, even if, like, the prime minister appeared on TV suggesting Italians to keep spending as they always did and no fear to have. And, of course, people are not really even actually listening to this kind of thing. They don't have the money to spend. Even if they wanted to spend it anyway, they wouldn't have them. So, yeah, there were, like, other protests, like starting from the low, from like the background, from the streets, that people spontaneously reacted to government decisions. Like there was a big thing you probably heard about around Naples when they wanted to dump all the trash from Europe, basically, underground where people actually still live. That was a big uprising. It wasn't, I mean, yeah, of course we call it a political one, but it wasn't really like a political movement behind it that organized and manipulated people. People uprise spontaneously. So I guess that's how we would see the reactions to the crisis in Italy, like how the people spontaneously react to it and they go against something, let's say that before they probably wouldn't have, or they wouldn't have seen the point of it. So it's becoming more and more like, from a logistical point of view, something to go against because you fear it just as a life instinct, let's say. So it's let's say there's not much movement on it organizing because they feel the crisis, but it's just something automatically happened, like spontaneously. And as Antonio was saying, like also this strategy of tension that I don't know if you heard about, but anyway, planting bombs or making facts happening to then blame something is a government strategy that often went on, like in Italy in the 70s, run mainly by the CIA, also in Greece and other countries, Ireland as well. And we can still see that in a way when exactly they send like a car full of fascists in front of a university, which is occupied by, of course, leftist students or anarchists. This causes a riot, and on TV, it makes it look like, oh, these poor skinhead guys went passing through and people beating them up and smashed their car, kind of thing. And again, to create more tension, same as if, like, people cannot create a known left-wing movement, otherwise they get beaten up. But what the media didn't show is how these fascists attacked a student demo during the morning of the same day, because they knew nobody like hardcore was around, so they knew they could simply go and beating like just students with a school bag. And that's what nobody on TV talked about, nobody on the government talked about the day after. But all they showed was actually the big riot when people with helmets arrived and wanted to give them a big beating, and then the coppers actually rescued them. So that's what you actually get on TV then. And yeah, we can still call it a strategy of tension, even if it's far away from planning a bomb and exploding a train station. But that's the point they're going to get to anyway, if they feel there is a need for it. And yeah, but mainly, as she said, if you have more specific questions, I mean, just talk to me straight. You know, we can try to see if there's some possible answer for it.
Thank you. Appreciate the chairs are sort of badly arranged in terms of a general discussion, but it's to fit everybody in. You've heard from all our speakers and a couple of the commonalities that were raised for me, and you might have noticed more, was firstly, there's rather obviously, there's a lot more going on in these countries than you generally hear about in the media. And the second thing is stories of increased tension that the far right seem to be mobilising more and more effectively. And but also that there's amazing displays of sort of solidarity and common action that hopefully give us hope and inspiration. Has anyone anything to say, or we're just turning it off?